Nightlife. Bite-sized history.
All around us, laws are changing as the government puts in place measures to fight the coronavirus. There are laws that limit where we can go, the reasons we're allowed to leave our homes, and the number of people who can meet together. Using the law to change behaviour is, of course, common to war. And I guess this is a kind of war, isn't it? And tonight, in our look at Australian history, we're actually going back more than 100 years to look at the way that Australia's laws changed during World War One. Back then, it wasn't so much about limiting public gatherings, although that did come into it, as it was about ensuring war supplies, putting anyone suspected of having German sympathies somewhere they couldn't make trouble, and trying to keep enthusiasm high for the war effort. And, of course, individual lives were caught up by these changes to the law. And so tonight in history, we're looking at some of the stories from that time with Catherine Bond, who's just written a book called Law in War, Freedom and Restriction in Australia During the Great War. And she joins us this evening. Catherine, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's right, great to have you with us too. I suppose in some ways now's a good time to reflect on laws in war because we're sort of in the middle of another one. Laws are changing around us in order to fight a different, very different kind of war, aren't we?
Absolutely. I mean, when I wrote the book, I obviously didn't have in mind the currency of the present situation that we are all living in right now, but it's certainly been alarming over the last few weeks as those increasing orders, those public health orders have started to come into play, introduced by the various states, and how quickly there's been a legal response to the pandemic and actually how much that mirrors our legal response or the legal response in the First World War in Australia.
Mm. I mean, the war was, of course, far away in Europe, but that didn't stop the fact that there were an extraordinary number of laws brought in or changed during World War One. Can you give us some idea of their scope? What were they intended to achieve?
So the whole idea was to harness the legal system to meet the end of victory in war. And that involved a whole range of very specific types of offences to meet this objective, to protect the public and to keep everything focused on the war effort. So during the war, there were hundreds of different restrictions on different rights and freedoms introduced, everything from an offence to wear or sell a military uniform if you didn't have permission to sell goods issued to you by the Red Cross, to use the word Anzac in business. But obviously the most restrictive of these curtailments were aimed at those who had been born in an enemy country and who the government feared may express some of those sympathies now that war had come around.
Well, yes, exactly. And to tell me the story of Franz Wallach, who was a naturalised British subject but fell foul of these laws. Well, who was he and where did he work?
So Franz Wallach had been born in Germany. He came out to Australia in the 1890s. And he renounced his German citizenship while at the same time becoming what was then known as a naturalised British subject. He married, he built a life for himself in Victoria, and he became the managing director of the Australian Metal Company. Now, unfortunately for Franz, in 1915, the little digger, Prime Minister, or he was soon to become Prime Minister, then Attorney General Billy Hughes, became very fixated on the Australian metal industry and the fact that a number of seemingly German companies were controlling the metal exports in Australia. So in addition to declaring the Australian Metal Company an enemy company, and that allowed him.
But hang on. What did he think the Australian Metal Company was doing? Did he think that they were shipping gun metal to the Germans or something, did he?
Essentially, yes. And Billy Hughes even wrote this in his memoirs later on. He said that the bullets that were being used on Australian soldiers and other soldiers from the Allies were being made from Australian metals. And he believed that one of the ways to stop this, both this control and what he perceived to be this horrific charge of Australian metal being used to kill Australian soldiers, was to wind all these companies up. And that included interning Franz Wallach. So Franz Bullock's story is particularly interesting because it's a really strong example of the over-the-top laws that were being passed during this time and the really over-the-top enforcement that was occurring too. Right.
Was there any evidence that this was happening, and what did Franz have any chance to defend himself?
So after he was interned, Franz Bullock challenged his internment. He lodged what's known as a writ of habeas corpus in the Supreme Court of Victoria, where he was released. He was rearrested 30 minutes later under a new government regulation and went to the High Court. But the High Court said that the regulation he was charged under was valid. He was the only person to challenge his internment in the High Court during this time. And the government wasn't called on to provide any evidence of this. All the minister had to have was a reason to believe. And Billy Hughes essentially provided him with that reason to believe or convinced him to intern Franz Wallach. The only evidence of any bad behaviour on the part of Franz Wallach is a couple of pages written by the Secretary of the Attorney General's Department, Sir Robert Garran. That is the only evidence that Franz Wallach ever did anything wrong.
Right.
I have found
no extensive evidence. Right, so there's no evidence that Hughes was ever justified in
No, not at all. And in fact, after the war, many German-born individuals were repatriated or deported because we didn't want to keep them in Australia after we'd treated them so badly. But actually, Franz Wallach wasn't. He was allowed to stay. He lived out his life in Victoria and became very successful once again too.
All right. What about, tell us about Adela Pankhurst and Jenny Baines. Now, Adela was the daughter of the famous suffragette Emmeline Pankhurst.
So yes, she was.
So what happened to them, and why was Adela Pankhurst in Australia during World War I anyway?
So early in 1914, though separately, Jenny Baines and Adela Pankhurst, who were both British suffragettes, had emigrated to Australia. Jenny Baines to escape the reach of the law, and Adela Pankhurst arguably because she actually had a falling out with her mother and her sisters. So unfortunately for Billy Hughes, he found himself with two British suffragettes in Australia at the start of the war. And in contrast to other suffragists or other women's rights advocates like Vida Goldstein, Baines and Pankhurst were ready to roll their sleeves up and get into a legal fight. They would not be censored. They would deliver speeches and publish material that really should have got them prosecuted for what was known as making statements likely to prejudice recruiting. It wasn't until 1917, though, when there were great food shortages. This was a really a very bad time during the war. There were a lot of food shortages, and these two women began to take to the streets, deliver speeches, and these gatherings would result in thousands of women and other individuals showing up. The government actually passed a war precautions regulation that meant that you couldn't gather outside Parliament in Melbourne at the time in a group of more than 20 people.
Right.
And eventually both Jenny Baines, Adela Pankhurst and another woman, Alice Souter, were arrested under this provision but actually released on a technicality by the High Court. Unfortunately for Adela, she still ended back up in jail the next month. She spent a few months in jail for inciting destruction of property. And then Jenny Baines became particularly active in 1918. Both of the women were socialists. And Jenny Baines kept continually getting arrested for flying the socialist red flag. and she, whenever she would go to jail, whenever she would go to court, it looked like she would go to jail. She would have a glass of milk to prepare herself for the hunger strike. And it's believed that she undertook at least one hunger strike during her time in jail as a result of these war precautions prosecutions.
So this Regulation 27, as it was known, of the War Precautions Act, forbidding gatherings. This was really aimed at protesters generally.
Yes.
I mean, the government didn't want anybody saying, "Look, the war is wrong."
Essentially, yes. The idea was to make sure that people wouldn't gather near Parliament to air their grievances. And there were a lot of public demonstrations out in the cities, out in the streets, but this one really focused on keeping people away from Parliament House at the time so that Parliament could keep doing, Parliament and the public service could keep running. Mm. But still, they would gather, and if they weren't charged under a war precautions regulation, they would might be police, state police at the time might charge them with a breach of a state law, like disruptive or offensive behaviour, for example.
I'm speaking with historian Catherine Bond, and we're talking about the kinds of laws that were passed in another period of war, you know, if that's what we're in at the moment, that's the First World War. Tell us about the case of Tom Barker, because he was a red ragger as well, wasn't he?
Yes.
And yep. The government took exception to him. Tell me about him.
So Tom Barker was a member of the Wobblies, or the Industrial Workers of the World, which was an organisation that was very left-leaning in its dogmas and its operation. So the Wobblies were viewed as a real threat during the war, particularly around the conscription referendums. And Tom Barker was the editor of the Wobbly newspaper Direct Action. He kept publishing material that was deemed to be likely to prejudice recruiting, and he kept ending up in jail. And then there would be a public outcry, there would be a lot of petitions, a lot of discussion because of this impact on freedom of speech. So this is something that was going on all the time, but you might not have realised it, because it was an offence to indicate that censorship, for example, of a newspaper had occurred at all. You couldn't leave blank space, you had to fill it. So Tom Barker became a real figurehead in this pushback against freedom of speech. So he would be arrested, tried, sent to jail. The Wobblies refused to pay any fines. And then there would be some kind of public outcry. He would be released, and then it would happen all over again. Unfortunately for Tom Barker, though, the ire that the Wobblies attracted led to the passing of the Unlawful Associations Act, which eventually banned membership of an organisation like the Wobblies. And he was then eventually arrested again and deported to Chile. And those membership provisions have been used even today, not in the Unlawful Associations Act per se, but those freedom of association restrictions still continue on today in different forms. Mm.
Yes, they are not such different times, are they? They really
are
not. I'm seeing all sorts of parallels here. All right, Catherine, yeah, good to talk.
Absolutely.
Good to talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.